Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Black Women Are Scary, the podcast that celebrates people of color writing in horror. Why horror, you might ask? For me, it's always been about confronting what scares me and overcoming my fears. Horror stories are new worlds where anyone can be a villain, anyone can be a hero, and it's not always who you think. I'm your host, Wimoto. I'm also the founder of Dusky Projects, a group of misfits that create horror and sci-fi works. We here at Dusky Projects are all about carving out spaces for adventure, imagination, and celebration while facing the monsters together. For our first episode of season two, we'll be doing a double feature. So let's lean in and listen to Family Line and Urban Wendy by Michelle Tracy Berger.
You barely notice your mother's tears and your father's solemn hug on the Amtrak platform as they release you into the muggy night. You're the oldest cousin, and they say it's time for you to make this special trip. You overhear your mother say to your father,
"Maybe. It's been long enough, and everyone's forgotten."
But you don't pay it any attention. You're looking good in your black jeans, wearing a gold belt that spells Nate. You're eager to get out of here as you've had way too many close calls with guys much tougher than you. Even though your younger cousins, Violetta, Corey, and little Tate strike you as interesting as a drawer of socks. You've only met them once at a family reunion. Their drawl and talk of porch sitting made little impression on you. You will call them Bammas, as a matter of course. You're a 16-year-old Bronx boy about to visit your backwards cousins in North Carolina for the first time. A familiar twitchy feeling of restlessness runs through you like a racehorse that's been held at the gate too long. You arrive and they love your wavy hair, your swagger, and your tales about spraying graffiti all over the city. By 2 weeks later, you've kissed all the hotties, rumbled with two guys, and seen all the snakes, raccoons, and trees that you can take. Just when you think you'll die of boredom, sitting on their grand wraparound porch, little Tate taps you on the shoulder and says,
"We got a book. A special book."
A year younger than you, but much taller and meatier. Linebacker ready. There's nothing little about him.
"This book is how Edward, one of our ancestors, got his freedom,"
Violetta chimes in with a dimpled smile. You'd peg her for slow because of her lisp, and although 12, she's babyish and wearing her hair in a one-sided ponytail. "Never heard of," you begin to say.
"Yeah, he stole beasts and spells from the savage lands, from his master's library, and learned its secrets."
Corey, Violetta's twin brother, interrupts, as he's been doing during your entire visit. A contrast to the steady mountain of little Tate. Corey's jumpy, impatient, picking at scabs on his legs and arms when he's not running his mouth.
"Shut up, Corey,"
Violetta says.
"Edward was an OG, original gangster,"
little Tate says, laughing. You lean back in the chair, and any lingering doubt about how stupid your cousins are vanishes. "Don't they teach you anything down here? Will you believe every dumb story you hear? Nobody ever earned their freedom with a book."
"Nate be afraid to see the book,"
Corey goads. He's in your face now, and you want to slap him. He's a bully, even without little Tate's girth and confidence.
"Cousins probably ain't never even been in the woods at night. That and the book made you run for the next train to New York.
Corey says. Me? Scared of a book? You howl with laughter and the pink Kool-Aid that you've been drinking snorts out your nose. You crazy. Hell, I've tagged trains in the middle of the night. What's some old book to me? At home, I've got men who will shoot me as soon as look at me. For a moment, you remember the train yards, the petty fights, and the effort it takes to stay out of trouble. Your cousins nod in unison, and little Tate looks satisfied, as if he's just scored a field goal. And with the challenge in the air, the pack of cousins and you trudge through their woods to see the slave shack where this book lives. You've never been to a slave shack, or any shack. Although it's getting dark and pinpricks rise along the back of your neck, you say nothing. You're tough. And, besides, they're just fucking with you, right? The walk is short, and soon you spy a building, roughly framed and fashioned of rough logs, chinked with mud, roof with tarred clapboards. Edward's shack was closest to the big house, because he tended to the massa, little Tate says.
Big house burned down long time ago,
Violetta adds as she opens the door. Your eyes adjust as she lights two blue candles. Pitiful place. Not even the size of the smallest bathroom in your house. No furniture, just a mud floor, one window, and musty rags moldering in crevices in the wall closest to you. In the middle of the room, an encyclopedia large, gilded, blue book sits open on a rotted log. You're not surprised that a book is here, but you are impressed with its size. So you put this book here just for me? Probably got this from some used bookstore before I got here, you say.
This is where the book stays,
Corey says, leaning down and brushing his fingertips across it.
It's been in the family forever,
Violetta says as she also bends down to touch the book. Her fingers glide across the width of it. Smoothing her skirt with care, she makes a place for herself on the log. Never heard about it. Besides, slaves down here weren't taught to read, you say.
Edward's master collected rare books, and some slaves here could read. And our Edward, he could read some.
Corey answers you and gives a nod to his brother. Ever think about what you might do if you were a slave? Little Tate asks. For a moment, you finger your name belt and imagine everything about you stripped away and extinguished. A momentary panic shoots through like when you're running on the train tracks and it's dark and you have to make sure not to touch the third rail. One touch of the rail and you'd be gone. I'd run and escape. That's what a racehorse would do, you think.
Please, little Tate says, holding up a hand. We all like to think we would have run. Some people did run. Some people stayed.
Edward didn't do any of those things,
Corey shouts. He is standing so close that some of his spit lands on your arm. Violetta looks to the bed and back to you as if she is waiting for something. You think, what a good actress she is because her mouth trembles some and she looks frightened. Everybody pauses.
Tell him,
she says.
Edward called a beast up, and it did his bidding,
little Tate says. Oh, brother, mutter. These Bammas are so dramatic, you think. Still, you lean in closer to the book, trying to imagine your ancestors moving his mouth slowly over the words on the pages that looked like ye old English. Bedtimes, chew, drink, It reminds you of a recent class on Shakespeare and Chaucer, a class you liked. How did he do it, you wonder? How did he steal the book, and when did he read it? Despite how ridiculous your cousins are being, a tiny bit of admiration for Edward snakes up inside you.
At first, the beast did,
Violetta says, a nervous giggle and a belch escaping from her lips. What happened, you ask? Edward started getting greedy? Like the beast was some kind of genie?
Nah. He asked for small stuff. Cornmeal, a blanket, bowls,
Little Tate says. Little Tate now bends down, just like his siblings did, and lingers on the page of the book, turning some over.
He did everything Edward asked.
Then Edward tried his hand at bigger things, like asking for the overseer to get sick,
Corey adds. You notice Corey's chest puff out with pride as he talks. At first, you don't believe it. Swirling blue mist rising from pages on the book? For real? You squat down and place your hand on the stump. Feels real. You squint, looking around for the gizmos, wires, cables, or machines that could produce this special effect. You were sweating when you walked in, and now the air feels cool in the shack. They are better at this hoodoo trick than you thought.
It promised him things,
Violetta says. You flinch when Corey roars.
The beast said it would kill the massa, but he wanted something in return,
Violetta continues.
A sacrifice,
Little Tate says, rising.
Poor Edward had a son, Nate. He was 16 too,
Violetta whispers. She gets up and stands next to Corey. She no longer seems so young. Corey and Violetta look united, purposeful. You wonder how long they have rehearsed this moment.
I get it. This is where you're trying to scare the city kid.
Nah. That beast wanted the son. Edward gave him his son for us, so that we could be free. Edward started over again. A new man, with money and land. He did it for us,
Corey says. Violetta reaches for his hand and he takes it and gives it a little shake. They all point at you, eyes big and wide.
You're the special one. The beast waits for one boy in every generation,
Little Tate says.
One sacrifice.
What you see forming in the mist makes you doubt everything you know. A faint shape, familiar, from field trips to museums, Dogs of Egypt, Anubis, Book of the Dead, Hermanubis, half man, half jackal. It's the head of the large jackal, its muzzle a yellow and dull gray. Soon its white torso appears. Its presence fills the room. You stare at its pointed salmon-colored tongue, drooling saliva. Violetta is the first to weep and shut her eyes. She leans into Corey for a moment.
They never told us it was so big. Shut up,
Corey says through clenched teeth. You rush headlong for the door and smack into the bulk of Little Tate. With studied ease, he turns you, holding you firmly under the neck and arm in a lock. Part of you wonders how many times he might have rehearsed this move. How long had he been preparing?
You're going to do this right, Nate. We have to do this, just like our parents did, and those before him,
Corey says. And now you remember your mother's last embrace, holding on so tight like she was losing you forever. You remember the quiet stories at family gatherings of distant uncles and cousins, all dying young, drowning, car accidents, fires and disappearances, always in North Carolina. But we've been free. Are free? Your dry mouth mumbles.
Beasts don't care,
Corey says now with a self-assured laugh. Hey, you all can make a different choice, you say, straining against your cousin's grip, hearing the pleading in every word you utter.
Who knows what'll happen if we don't offer someone up? What we'll lose?
Corey says with a shrug. Little Tate's lips brush against your ear.
He's family, just like you,
he whispers. In the struggle, you start to wonder, what had you done with all that freedom you had gathering up around you like pools of unused stretchable fabric? Little Tate releases you back to the corner of the room. As Corey's knife rams into the soft spot above your collarbone and you fall, you see no doubt in your cousin's eyes. You see a beast's shadow and madness. The wound is deep, and although your fingers grip the long knife and pull it out, you know it's over. You've seen this before on the streets too many times. Violetta yells,
we've got to get some of his blood or they'll be mad. It's leaking out so fast. I know,
Corey says. Little Tate bends down next to you and with trembling hands tries to unscrew the top of the mason jar. The dish-shaped lid rolls away from him and next to you.
Stupid,
Violetta calls out. You turn your head away from your cousin's fumbling. You thought you might die along the train tracks, running from the police, or shot for your sneakers, or beaten by men who have nothing better to do. Lots of people die for stupid reasons. For less than this, you think. For less than wisdom. For less freedom. For less than Edward's sacrifice. Your blood finds its way down your chest, to your stomach, and drips into the belt buckle. You clutch it. I am Nate. I am free now, and will die free. Metasol pulls another strand of red hair from a perfectly glazed Dunkin' Donut, holds it up and looks at the stray bits of delicate pink icing clinging to the hair. Metasol reminds herself that her other team members working this shift don't have red hair, nor does anyone else working here. Wendy is here. When Metasol announced she was leaving Wendy's to work at Dunkin' Donuts 2 weeks ago, her coworkers warned her. Expect a visit from Wendy, they said. Metasol looked at the goofy-looking freckled girl on the napkin she had handed out so many times to snot-nosed kids, harried mothers, and dope addicts.
She doesn't like it when you leave without warning,
one of them whispered. You gotta be kidding me. I'll tell her a thing or two, Metasol says. She filed their concerns of Wendy the Phantom Stalker under another urban legend and said goodbye to the drab brown uniform, the never-ending work of keeping the salad bar clean and organized, and sought her fortune among coffee and donuts. Metasol's first week away from Wendy's had been peaceful at Dunkin' Donuts. No dreams, no nightmares, no prognostications from any cartoon characters with red hair. By the second week, Metasol fielded daily complaints about bad donut batches, curdled creamer, and mixed up orders. Now the hair. She twirls her fake emerald stud earring while she thinks. She needs this job until her jewelry business turns a profit. She sighs and pushes her thumb into the small of her aching back. She arches, but there is no satisfying crack of vertebrae. Too many nights, she thinks, hunched over her small table littered with clusters of garnet, peridot, and citrine, checking internet orders, hoping for a big sale. Not much luck so far.
This isn't what I ordered.
A man plops down a box of donuts. Metasol peers in. What's wrong? She says, straining under her customer service smile.
I ordered vanilla glaze. These are hot as hell.
He rests his beach ball-sized stomach onto the counter. She plucks a small red candy off a donut, smells it, and puts it in her mouth. It burns. Her fingers rush over the register. I'm so sorry. I'll get that corrected right away. By the end of the day, she's filled it 26 wrong orders. Yawning, Metasol makes her way from the Dunkin' Donuts kiosk through the subway tunnel to the station, dodging many sleeping men and some women, addicts of one kind or another who murmur, shake, and rage. She hugs her purse and wipes powdered sugar from the front of her jacket. A tug at her elbow makes her look down at the small girl walking beside her. The girl's face is a spray of pimples and freckles. Her red pigtails are lopsided, and when the girl smiles, her mouth seems to open and lengthen like a tiny alligator's. Metasol pulls away. This is not happening, she thinks. Metasol weaves through the crowd, trying to mix in with the crush of people and catch her breath. Metasol does not believe in spirits, but her family does. She knows at least one thing to try. She grabs a white 7-day candle from her mother's stash under the sink and lights it. She runs a bath, dumps in rose water and sea salt to ward off whatever Wendy is. She slips her dark body into the bath and tries not to think of hamburgers, donuts, or little red-haired girls. Metasol feels calm the next day. Everything's going okay.
Smoke break?
Her coworker with blonde, bouncy curls says.
Sure,
Metasol says and nods. I'll cover. They're in the slowest part of the day, 12 to 2. No kids going to school or coming home, and no one yet needs an afternoon sugar lift. She watches as her coworker leaves the kiosk.
Metasol,
she hears her name whispered. She looks over the counter and then behind her. The voice gets louder.
Metasol,
is someone behind the condiment stand? Metasol comes around the counter and looks into the pack of straws near the soda machine. The straws are covered in their white coats except for one. She pulls the fiery red one out. It glows in her hand. Holding the straw close, she sees a tiny plastic face of the freckled girl smirking. Stop following me, Metasol says. You're gonna get me fired.
I didn't want you to leave. It's not your time to move on yet. I know about more than burgers,
Wendy says. Metasol's face reddens. You ever try working a salad bar after church congregations come in? I hated telling people to stop picking at olives if they hadn't paid for the salad. Wore me down.
I'll get you a different station,
Wendy says. I need better pay, Metasol says.
If you come back, I could work on that. I miss you.
Metasol sees Wendy's lips thin out and upturn briefly, but her small imprinted face looks lopsided. Metasol considers, how many more pieces of malachite could she buy with a raise?
Is that all you want? better pay?
Wendy says. She shakes her head at such a stupid question. In the palm of her hand, Metasol feels heat from the straw. She shuffles the straw to the other hand. She feels the warmth from the straw penetrate into her hand and travel up through her arm. What are you? Metasol says.
Total quality control.
Wendy says as the straw dissolves in Metasol's hand. Metasol wonders if she had too many vanilla frosted donuts. Late that night, exhausted, Metasol wanders through the subway tunnel and rounds her usual corner. She feels someone walking too close, but when she turns around, he's already there, covering her mouth and pulling her to him. The man smells like sweat and onions. From memory, she executes the only move that she remembers from a high school self-defense class. She lifts her right foot and stomps on what she prays is the top of the man's foot. He registers no pain, but responds by slamming her into the wall. Pinning her, he leans in and bites the top of her eyebrow. When a scream finally erupts from Metasol, it carries it with a cry for help, for it not to end like this. Between the pain and the body-shaking fear, a sliver of regret pierces her. She thinks of all the attention she pays to cuts of amber, tourmaline, emerald, and sapphire, rather than to the feel of the sun kissing her face, her mother's crooked half-smile, or the simple pleasure of bouncing her niece on her knee. Ashamed, her mind stretches into the night, discharging energy like a thin finger of lightning. Another guttural scream mixes in with Metasol, and in a moment she feels the man's hands drop away. Metasol turns and sees the man in ragged clothes, looking stunned. Blood trickles from his ears. People are coming toward her, asking if she is all right. Hands with tissues dab at her scraped and bleeding face. She pants, a metallic taste rising on her tongue. She overhears someone say, "Wasn't a little girl with her just a moment ago?" Metasol looks past the crowd into the tunnel, but just sees strangers. "A little red-haired girl?" Metasol asks with a croak, her voice dry. No answer back. Tonight, she'll light a fat red candle, one her mother uses to invite an emissary in. She will wait and listen. Tomorrow, she will go back to burgers and fries. Donuts aren't for her, after all.
Thanks so much for joining us. Family Line and Urban Wendy was written by Michelle Tracy Berger, directed by Kennedy Allen, sound designed by Gabe Castro, and produced by Dusky Projects. You can support us Scary Black Women with a rate or review, or by dropping by our monthly macabre mixer. Our episodes air the first Friday of every month, and we continue the festivities with our online mixers, where we showcase new authors and new scary stories. Till next time.